I'm having an immensely good time here in Fairbanks. I like the weather. I've been given an extremely comfortable apartment by the university and the use of a state motor car, which is an enormous convenience. I've been treated with a great deal of consideration by Professor Distad. I've got two good classes to teach. I'm working hard finishing a book that's been much too long delayed. I have a research project going. Am I talking loud enough?
That's fine. Just speaking.
I have a research project with Professor James Burnham of the Department of Mathematics that we hope to finish. I've made contact with a local church of my faith, and I've been very warmly welcomed by the congregation. I've met a great many students, both professionally and socially, and an enormous number of extremely interesting colleagues on the faculty in many disciplines, all the way from anthropology to marine zoology. I'm just having a wonderful time.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I understand you're teaching two classes, and there seems to be quite a bit of diversity. One, a basic, then what's it, an honors calculus
class. That's correct. One's an honors freshman calculus.
Freshman calculus, and the other one is
it's a graduate course in what's called Fourier analysis, which is one of my...
That is one of your specialties.
One of my scientific specialties.
Our interest, I guess.
Well...
They're probably synonymous. How are the classes going?
Very well. The freshmen found me something of a shock.
Why?
Many of them had never been exposed to genuine mathematics prior to enrolling in my class, and they found it rather a shock. I urged them, however, to understand that mathematics is quite hard. It's a difficult subject. It's at least as hard as running a marathon. Quite little. I mean that in the literal sense of the word. It's as difficult to do mathematics as well as it is to run 26 miles. And nobody expects to learn to run a marathon in 3 weeks. People know that you have to spend 5 years of training several hours every day of the week, 52 weeks a year, in order to become good enough to compete in marathons. And I think I've got that across to these fine young people. They're an extraordinarily nice bunch of students. I like them all. They've been carefully selected in advance for the honors program, and it's a great privilege to teach them.
When you say genuine mathematics, they weren't quite, had never been approved. What do you mean by genuine besides
that? I mean mathematics in which we prove things. There are a great many activities that go by the name of mathematics. Many of them involve simply following instructions. Take the cookbook off the shelf, and it says, add a derivative, integrate twice, compute three times, and you get the answer. But with that sort of approach, one doesn't understand what's going on. And a person who is going to be a mathematician or is going to use mathematics in his or her profession is miles ahead of the game if he or she learns why he or she is doing what he or she is doing. Learning the whys as well as the hows. If a student, whether he or she be an engineer, a physicist, chemist, even a biologist, in fact perhaps even particularly a biologist nowadays with the quantitative methods that are coming in, actually knows what these tools mean, what integrals mean, what derivatives mean, what infinite series mean, what statistics really means, he or she will be far, far ahead. So while some of the students find the experience initially painful, I think in the long run they'll find that it's going to pay off for them.
So can I summarize your statement in saying that you're feeling that you're teaching the people to use math, pencil, and paper rather than the workbook? Like, instead of having to plug in the answers, they have to go derive them and work everything out.
They should know what they're doing, yes. That's pretty much it.
How would these freshmen you're talking about now, who you're teaching. How would those compare with a comparable class that you run into in Washington or New South Wales or any of the other universities you've been to?
Same level. In some ways, these young people are more sophisticated. Many of them have lived in France. They travel widely. Vacations in Hong Kong or Bangkok are quite common among Alaskans, I've discovered.
That's pretty good.
They know the United States, the lower 48, is very well. They've got they do not have a parochial outlook at all.
What about the math?
Well, that's the thing. Many of the high schools in the state of Alaska don't offer very good mathematics. Now, that's also true of high schools in the state of Washington.
I'm not trying to.
It's true of high schools in the state of New South Wales.
It is true they do.
Yeah, well, that's an unfair comparison because the mathematics taught in New South Wales is taught in various groups, and what the best group gets is very, very good. I doubt that a freshman in the United States, in any of the 50 states, could pass the high school leaving examination, even in New South Wales. It's like tough. Yeah, but that's beside the point.
Thanks. How are your graduates? How's your graduate high school?
Oh, they're good. They're a good bunch. They have varied backgrounds. Some are from applied disciplines, biology. Others are pure mathematicians. I'm having a great time with them. Having a good time.
Sounds like you're getting a different perspective. Are you getting a new perspective up here?
Well, a new perspective on what?
Well, with your students.
Oh, no. I taught my first class 41 years ago, 42 years ago now, in a university, and I could almost say I've seen them all.
You've taught at a number of different universities.
That's correct.
What are some besides Washington, the three that I mentioned?
I began as an instructor at Harvard. I then spent 3 years as a civilian scientist with the United States Air Force, 1942-1945. I flew in B-17s and B-24s, was decorated by the President of the United States for combat flying as a civilian. I was in charge of aerial gunnery for the entire 8th Air Force.
You're the one who designed the patterns, or?
Yes, exactly. And in order to be sure they were correct, I had to go up and try them out.
Okay. Well, the formation would throw 11 tons a minute?
Or? Oh, no, nothing like that. They wouldn't carry that much
the other day.
They wouldn't carry that much in the way of bombs. We only carried 2 tons of bombs per plane. But it was very primitive airplanes. But then I was at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton for a year following the war, the end of the Second World War, and made my first completely independent mathematical discoveries there. Taught for 1 year at Bryn Mawr, 1 year at the University of Chicago on a temporary appointment. In 1948, I joined the faculty of the University of Washington, and I've been on that faculty ever since.
West and North.
I've steadfastly resisted being chairman of a department. I've been asked many times, but I've never felt I wanted to do that. I have been chairman of the faculty senate of the University of Washington, which was 2 years in most extreme sort of university politics. It took
hours, I'm sure.
It took 2 years out of my scientific life. Just completely excised. I've had guest appointments. I went back to the Institute for Advanced Study once again. I spent 1 year at the University of Uppsala in Sweden as a visiting professor. That was a glorious experience. Wonderful place. I was visiting professor at Yale for a year. I was visiting professor at the University of Texas, Austin, for a year. I was visiting professor at the University of Moscow, USSR, for a year. I've had shorter appointments from 3 to 6 months at the Australian National University in Canberra, University of New South Wales, University of Western Australia, University of Hokkaido in Japan. I've had an extremely varied life.
One question you brought up, you said after World War II, you did your first original mathematical.
Well, no, my doctor's thesis was, I wrote that in 1941, and that was it was a pretty good thesis. People still quote it. Okay. It had some original ideas in it. And in fact, when I've gone to Moscow, I've heard them lecturing on it. But I broke entirely new ground in the work that I started in Princeton in 1945-46.
And what was that on?
It was called Rings of Continuous Functions.
So that was 45-46?
Yeah, I began that time.
I'll make sure I had the right time frame on that.
Yeah.
And that was part one. You just recently completed part two.
Yeah.
Why the difference?
Well, I left the field completely, and I spent my time doing completely different things. And then when I went to the Soviet Union in 1971, I met two remarkable young men named Chudnovsky, Chudnovsky, just extraordinary mathematicians, Jewish, living in Kiev in conditions that can only be described as squalor. And they were very much interested in that work of mine. And I had completely left the field. I did other things. I didn't even remember much of what it was about, except in broad outline. The paper that I wrote left a number of questions unanswered, things I simply couldn't deal with. And it turned out that I couldn't deal with them for a very good reason, because the science of set theory, mathematical logic, had not progressed at that time to a state where the problems could be successfully attacked. In the 50s and early 60s, a number of logicians, including Paul Cohen and Dana Scott, had made remarkable advances in what is called set theory. And these two young Russians had gobbled all that up, and they were able to apply the new work to the old problem. And so many of the questions that I'd asked were completely solved in the second part.
So your second paper is stimulated by your work with the Russians?
Yeah, and the second paper is a joint work with those Russians. Okay. They're now in the United States, and I think they'll try to become U.S. citizens.
Are they teaching States?
They're at Columbia University, yeah.
You mentioned the University of Oslo was a unique experience.
Oh, it was just fine. I was there in 1951-1952. And Sweden at that time was still Sweden. It's now become shockingly Americanized. They've got 4-lane superhighways all over the country. Extraordinarily high standard of living. And many of the old traditions are gone, but they still lived on then. They took the Lucia Fest very seriously. I was admitted to a student club, and everybody had to belong to a student club, or as they call them, nation, nation in Swedish. I just reveled in it. I learned how to ski cross country. During the Easter recess, I spent 2 weeks in the wilderness of Lapland, even farther north than they are here, up to about 69 degrees north. It was superb.
Too bad you aren't here, going to be here next semester, because in the spring our students take off the Brooks Range. There is a 10-day cross-country ski in the Brooks Range.
Well, I'm a little old for it now, I think.
It pays for the slope.
I was 31 years old then.
Excuse me. catch up.
Go ahead, no problem.
You mentioned that you've been decorated by the president.
Yeah.
For your military,
Combat flying.
Military related. Your combat flying.
Sure, it was military.
Sure. What are some of the other honors that you've received in your life that you're particularly happy with, particularly glad to receive? I'm sure in your life you've received many. Which ones stick out?
Mr. Lee, I just don't worry about those things. They don't mean much to me one way or the other.
That's why I was asking which ones you enjoyed. But you mentioned the one about the military.
Well, that I was kind of proud of. In retrospect, at the time I was not very much impressed with it, but I look back on it, it was pretty nice.
That's why I asked that
question. Yeah.
A couple other questions I'd like to.
I enjoyed being University Marshal at the University of Washington, lead the academic sessions at that point. That was fun.
Sounds like that, based on what you're saying in Sweden, you like some of the traditional aspects of the university life.
Oh, certainly. I greatly enjoyed the visit of John F. Kennedy to the University of Washington in 1961. I was his classmate at Harvard College, and I had bought a new doctor's gown for the occasion. Paid $180 for the thing. It was crimson silk, Harvard doctor's gown. Then the authorities got wind of the fact that I knew him, and they made me his valet. So I couldn't march in the procession. I was in the robing room,
okay,
helping the president any way I could. And I had this brand new gown, and they'd given the president a rather shabby black rental gown from our university bookstore. So I offered him mine and put it on him. And he looked down and he said, "Isn't this more for bishops?" I said, "No, Mr. President, it's a Harvard doctor's gown, and I believe you have an honorary doctor's degree from Harvard. You're entitled to wear it." So he said, "All right," and he wore it. And he looked great in it.
How did you look in the rental gown?
I didn't march. I had to stay behind.
I was just wondering.
I was in the robing room, and that was kind of nice. The last time I ever saw Kennedy, I knew him reasonably well as an undergraduate.
Had you been one of your students, or you been?
No, we were in the same class.
Oh, I see.
We were on the Harvard swimming team together. He gave remarkably good parties.
That's what everything I've read about him sounds like. He enjoyed Harvard.
Right.
You were a swimmer in college, then.
That's correct.
Do you continue to swim?
I swam for many years, but I don't swim anymore. Except just a little, nothing serious.
You've mentioned cross-country skiing. What other physical disciplines?
I climbed a lot of mountains, a great many mountains in the state of Washington and in Sweden and in the Swiss and French Alps. But I've sort of given that up. I raced motor cars for a while. I had a Mercedes-Benz racing car for about 10 years.
And where were you racing in the States?
Oh, just around. Mostly road races.
What other hobbies do you have?
I've done cabinet making a little. Oh, heavens, I forgot the most important one. I play the horn, the French horn. I was second French horn in the Moscow University Orchestra. Played in 15 concerts all over the western part of the Soviet Union. I played in the Canberra Symphony. I played in a Seattle Symphony. I left my horn at home when I came up here, though. Thought I'd just give it a rest for a while. I want to finish a book while I'm here.
You're finishing the book now. You've written a number of books.
I published three books in collaboration with two people. And
the same two people?
No. Yeah, well, two books with one guy and another book with a second chap. This fourth book is on my own. I've translated more books than I care to mention. I can't even count them. Probably five. From Russian to English. I do that not for the money, because there isn't much money in it. And furthermore, the taxes are confiscatory, as you know. I do it as a favor to my friends. Some good Soviet colleague says, "You just got to translate my book for me. Nobody else can do it right." And I'll probably do it for them.
you would have both a linguistic background and mathematical background.
Yeah, you have to be, first of all, a good mathematician to do it, right? You've got to know the language, but a good mathematician with a shaky knowledge of language is better than a person who knows Russian perfectly but doesn't know the mathematics.
Because you're really talking about two languages there.
Right.
The math is the primary language.
Very true.
You're going to be doing a program fairly soon during a colloquium series. You'll be doing a general public lecture. What are you going to be covering?
In my public lecture, I'm going to talk on a, I hope, a catchy title. The title is Even Mathematicians Are Odd.
Okay.
And that's a joke that everybody gets. There is not a literate person that knows English that doesn't know about even numbers and odd numbers.
Right.
And that, by the way, is a play on words that cannot be done in any other language that I know of. It doesn't make any sense in German, French, Swedish, or Russian.
What about Australia?
Well, of course, it's upside down. Yeah. Oh, they do indeed. They've got some beauties. But the theme of this talk is first what is mathematics like? I described something of the history of mathematics and how it's the only human science that has, except for observational astronomy, that's remained unchanged throughout recorded history. If you look at physics, biology, chemistry, you see that those subjects are completely and wholly different from what they were at the time of the ancient Greeks, to say nothing of the Babylonians and Egyptians. Mathematics of the Greeks is just as good as our mathematics today. In fact, you can make a case that from the time of Euclid, it's been downhill for mathematics. His work is flawless. It's like the Parthenon. So, from that base, I go on and describe some of the greatest mathematicians of history: Archimedes, Newton, Gauss. And that takes an hour. I've got a number of transparencies that I project on the screen. I've given this talk twice.
You say Euclid's work was flawless. Why do you say that?
Because it was. I don't...
Right.
There's a mathematician's answer. We're a little bit like computers. You have to frame your questions just right for us.
Well, actually, I was going to say is that his work, or his surviving work, was flawless.
Well, we don't know about the work that didn't survive. If there wasn't, in fact,
sure,
he may have done other things, but no trace of them remains, and nobody has any idea what they might have been. But Euclid's elements are just perfect. They've got axioms. They've got proofs. They show a profound understanding of the deep problems in mathematics. He recognized that his famous fifth axiom, to wit, two parallel lines will never meet no matter how far they're extended, is in fact an axiom. It's simply not anything you can prove. It's a beautiful piece of work. It's in mathematics, it is to mathematics what the Parthenon is to architecture. We've got much bigger buildings than the Parthenon, but nothing any better. We've got much more elaborate structures in mathematics than Euclid, but we've got nothing any better.
I see what you're saying.
Right.
What would you, talking about your own mathematical work, say Euclid's, you're talking about Euclid's work, but what of your work do you want to be remembered for?
Oh, well, that's for the world to say.
What do you think the world will
I don't know. Really? I don't know. There's one paper. I've written something like 135 research papers in my career. I've printed them, published them. And there's one paper I wrote with a very dear friend named Herbert S. Zuckerman, now deceased, tragically died at the age of 58. He killed himself with cigarettes, I think. It was terrible. He was a brilliant man and a wonderful, wonderful mathematician and an extraordinarily good guy. We wrote one paper which, if interpreted in physical terms, deals with the destruction of matter. It is a very, very technical subject. But I've been hoping the physicists would come along and use that, and they never have. They might in 100 years, you don't know.
You have got a physicist friend you can suggest you look at it?
I've tossed out a hint now and then to physicists, but they've never taken me up on it. That paper on rings of continuous functions is still well known.
Both parts.
Well, the second part hasn't been around long enough for people to understand and to appreciate it. It takes a little while for these things to sink in. I've worked in a huge number of different things, Mr. Lang.
I understand that. That's why.
All over the map. I've written on music theory with a chemist. It amounts to a book, a small book on the mathematics of music. And that's attracted a fair amount of attention. Musicologists have written to me about it with much interest. It's slightly inaccessible to U.S. readers because it's written in German.
You've mentioned your work with the Soviet Union, your colleagues.
Yeah, yeah.
Has your work with the Soviet Union been sounds like a very pleasant ongoing relationship you have with certain colleagues?
Oh, yeah. They're nice guys. Their government is atrocious, as we all know. It is a terrible government. But the people are wonderful.
How do the ebbs and flows of our Detente or Cold War affect your professional relationship?
They don't affect my professional relationship one way or the other. They make it a little awkward to go there. My four trips to the Soviet Union were, with one exception, made under the aegis of the National Academy of Sciences under the exchange program, so that when I arrived in Moscow, I was the guest of the Academy, which is a very different thing from being a guest of our Academy. The Soviet Academy of Sciences, the Akademie Nauk, is a very powerful, well-funded arm of the government. They have a fleet of motor cars, they have branches in every major city of the Soviet Union. They control science. It's completely unlike anything in the West.
They even control the university science?
No, but they're close connections. They don't directly control the universities. But you're treated beautifully if you're a guest of the Academy. You get more rubles than you can possibly spend, literally. You get what by Soviet standards is a very comfortable room in either an apartment house or a hotel. You have permission to travel. You're sent to, if you've got a reason, you can always visit other major centers. I've spent time in Kiev, Odessa, Tbilisi, Tashkent, Novosibirsk, Almaty, all because the Academy sent me. If you go privately, there's nothing like that you can do. You can't even buy a railroad ticket.
Okay.
Literally.
Yeah, I understand.
You walk down to the railroad station and say, I want to go to Kiev, then you won't even get much conversation. You certainly won't get a ticket. If you're a guest of the Academy, a nice fellow shows up in your hotel room with a round-trip ticket to Kiev, and he puts you on the train, and off you go, and back you come.
Sounds like the way to go.
So, the Reagan administration has seen fit to cancel that exchange program, which in my opinion is very foolish. It doesn't harm the Soviets very much. It harms us as much as it harms them. And bridges between people are really the only way we're going to solve this problem. the Soviets aren't going to go away, and their government is not going to collapse. We wish it would, many of us, and every right-thinking person wishes for reforms. The Soviet system, it's time they stopped putting their citizens in jail, it's time they stopped invading other countries, and certainly they shouldn't shoot down unarmed civilian airplanes. But keeping a few scientists from visiting the Soviet Union and a few Soviet scientists from visiting the United States isn't going to change that.
On your exchanges, have you had reciprocal exchanges? Had your Soviet colleagues join you in the States?
One of them has. Later, and he had a whale of a time called him Arkady Maltsev. Great guy. Oh my, wonderful man. Good mathematician. Very friendly, charming. Hugely good-natured, outgoing. He spent 3 months in Seattle. Couple of years after I'd been in the Soviet Union.
Good exchange.
Yeah. Oh, just great.
In the other countries you visited, you've done work. You've also.
Oh, I forgot to mention Germany. I was visiting professor in Erlangen for 7 months. Heavens, wonderful time there too.
It sounds like you enjoy wherever you go.
Yes, I do. I have a great time. I just love mathematics, and I like being around mathematicians, and I have been greatly blessed with dear friends in many, many countries.
As taking this one step further,
yeah.
Why did you come to Alaska?
Well, I've known Professor Distan for a long time, and I've known his colleagues. Some of them very well, Professor Andreessen, Professor Head, Professor Burnham, whom I hadn't met before I came here, but whose work I've known. And I just said, well, why not?
Well, I don't blame you, but frequently people don't realize we have a first-rate school here. So
it is. It's a splendid school.
And that's why I was asking.
Yeah. Well, I've been here before.
That's right. You were here about spring of
November, about 5 years ago. I've forgotten the exact year.
I think it was just after I came here.
It might very well have been. And I liked it. It was cold, but it was very pleasant indeed. So when Professor Distan wrote me, I thought it over for all of 60 seconds. And right. Of course, I had to get leave of absence from the University of Washington, but that was...
Sounds like they've been
readily granted.
In the past.
Oh, very cooperative. As long as they don't have to pay any money.
Washington's financial state, that might be.
In fact, they're not at all displeased to have people go on leave. It redounds to the credit of University of Washington for one thing, and then it reduces their payroll.
Combination. Do you have a family?
I've been married twice and divorced twice. I'm single. I have two grown daughters, both flourishing in their professions. One's a banker. She's a loan officer with the Wells Fargo Bank in Los Angeles. And the other is a professional translator. She works for the Central Intelligence Agency and translates from the Russian.
Sounds like they benefited from your traveling too.
Both went with me to Russia. The elder daughter, the banker, spent an academic year in a Soviet high school, and that was quite an eye-opener. She saw things that no adult would ever see.
Gives you an insight that you didn't have.
Hmm?
Gives you a new insight, too.
Oh, indeed. Such things as meeting a badly burned and crippled young man at a party. It turned out that he was a fighter pilot. And he sustained his injuries in Vietnam. It wasn't widely known that they had Soviets flying the airplanes.
I'd heard that accusation, but I never heard it confirmed.
Well, I didn't see the guy myself. So it's hearsay evidence. But it was just completely accepted. The way the Soviets accept East Germany. they think of East Germany as part of the Soviet Union.
Brings back the Wiley's, the Tocqueville quote that we've heard so many times about the, where the two nations will be going.
Yeah.
Well, let me, I appreciate your time. Well, I've jumped around a lot of things. Is there anything that I've not asked? I've jumped around a lot of questions. Is there anything I've not asked you that I should have?
Not that I know of. I love being a mathematician, and I'm grateful to be practicing my profession here under these ideal circumstances.
Well, I have to ask you one last question. As a UW college professor who likes academia, who's UW been playing the role for this year?
Well, I have a little agreement with the coach. He doesn't teach calculus, and I won't teach football.
You don't, with your mathematical background, you don't even make odds.
Certainly not. No. I don't know anything about football. My personal opinion is that you have the very best football program there is.
Yes, sir.
Time on that tape?
Sir.
I think college football is a national disgrace.
In what way?
It exploits the players. They do difficult, dangerous work, and they're very ill paid for it. The profits are immense, as everybody knows. There's a huge amount of hypocrisy. These young men that play university football in the United States are not students for the most part at all. Many of them are illiterate. Literally.
Absolutely.
They can't sign their names. They can barely read the playbook.
I used to be a sports writer. I agree with you totally. In Texas, of all places, I saw it's a religion down there.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's just terrible. I found it very offensive at the University of Texas. Worse even than the University of Washington. Occasionally, people from the sports department have tried to meddle in my teaching. And I take a very firm line with that. I tell them to talk to my dean. I have nothing to do with the sports department. They want to inquire about student X, Y, or Z. Send the request through channels. They ask about the student's progress. I say, send the student to me. I had one scandalous case 2 or 3 years ago. I was teaching a pre-calculus mass course to 600 students. There was some big star, football star, that took a very high line with me about that course. Of course, I said, I can't come to the lectures. I'm too busy. But I've got a tutor, he said. I said, fine. We'll grade your exam like we grade everybody else's. And he sent in a ringer to the final. But with 600 people, I couldn't catch him. He hadn't been to any of the classes to speak of. He hadn't taken any of the our exams. But his name came in on a perfect final. It goes on all the time. At the University of Texas, I taught a pre-calculus so-called popular course, and I got almost threats. These guys are big, and they want to pass. They tell you they got to get a B. Mm-hmm. I took the coward's way out with those people. I simply gave them the grades they got and left town.
I'm sure you've been following the news on H. Ross Perot's. How was it worded? Traitorous charges. Traitorous suggestion that the Texans are charging with. You've heard his proposal.
No. What does he suggest?
H. Ross Perot's.
I know who he is.
He was appointed by the governor of Texas to be a panel on educational excellence, and he had the audacity to suggest that football players have to pass 4 classes instead of 3. No interscholastic football or any athletics before 7th grade.
Oh my God.
And after in junior high, there's nothing on weeknights.
Isn't that appalling?
Let you hear one more of my soapbox things.